Matthew chapter 6, and I was quite encouraged when I saw the title, Do Not Worry, at verse 25. And we're going to be reading through to verse 34. And then for the second part of the reading, we're going to jump back into the Old Testament, into Ecclesiastes, and the reading will begin on page 668 in chapter 2 of Ecclesiastes. But first of all, let's start in Matthew chapter 6 at verse 25. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more important than food, and the body more important than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? Who of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to his life? And why do you not worry about clothes? See how the lilies of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you, but not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? So, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Now we're going to turn back to Ecclesiastes. So if you find Psalms, and then just go forward, next book's Proverbs, and then Ecclesiastes. We're just going to begin on page 668 of the Church Bibles, at chapter 2. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheating myself with wine and embracing folly, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects and built houses for myself and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and the treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man. I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for my labor. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. Then I turned my thoughts to consider wisdom, and also madness and folly. What more can the king's successor do than what has already been done? I saw that wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. The wise man has eyes in his head, while the fool walks in the darkness. But I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. Then I thought in my heart, the fate of the fool will overtake me also. And then what then do I gain by being wise? I said in my heart, this too is meaningless. For the wise man, like the fool, will not be long remembered. In days to come, both will be forgotten. Like the fool, the wise man too must die. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? Yet he will have control over all the work into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. So my heart began to despair over all my toilsome labor under the sun. For a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This too is meaningless and a great misfortune. What does a man get for all the toil and anxious striving with which he labors under the sun? All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too, I see, is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, God gives wisdom, knowledge, and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand over to the one who pleases God. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. This is the word of God.
And for leading us in reading the scriptures this evening, can we turn again at Ecclesiastes 2? Let's get a bit of orientation by reading in verse 1. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. I'm not sure if you're familiar with Johnny Cash, but Johnny Cash and U2 put together a great song called The Wanderer. In fact, if you look in the Smith and Facebook, you will go right onto a YouTube clip of Johnny Cash singing The Wanderer. And it really is very, very powerful because it's based on the book of Ecclesiastes. And the book of Ecclesiastes is based basically on a premise that you have a very smart man, you've got a very thoughtful person who goes out into the world and who looks around and who thinks about what life is all about, who's really considering the things of life. One man, Sinclair Ferguson, has described him like a pundit, you know, a football pundit who looks around and who comments on the affairs of life. He calls his book in Ecclesiastes a pundit's folly. That's certainly what we have here in Ecclesiastes 2. It asks the big questions. And it asks the questions which I believe that many of us here tonight are asking. And these are the questions like, is life worth living? What is the significance of life? And maybe we're saying, well, what is the meaning and purpose of pain and disappointment? Because there are times in our lives when, quite frankly, we are devastated. We're devastated by the way things have worked out. We're devastated by what we call providence. The lot that we have been cast in life and the way life seems to be going. The future has disappointed us. The past, rather, has disappointed us. And the future holds very little encouragement for us. Now, we might ask ourselves, who are we speaking to tonight? Ecclesiastes is not primarily a book for non-Christians. It was written for believers. And it's part of what we call wisdom literature. In other words, it's a part like Psalms and Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. It was written for the people of God to instruct them in wisdom, how life should be lived, a kind of manual of aphorisms in the case of Proverbs, but really a philosophy of life. And I hope that many of us, all of us, have a coherent philosophy of life. Especially those of you who are younger, who are now in your teens and 20s, as you are growing up, you're asking, well, what is going to shape my future? What's it going to be like in my 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and beyond. And so wisdom looks at how humanity behaves in the complexity of life. If you hang about airports a lot, you'll be drawn maybe to all these books that look on, all these books written about, you know, human behavior. I don't know why, but I'm drawn to these things at airports, especially about kind of pop psychology and how do people do certain things. I was looking at one the other week there, how to be an effective manager for some reason. I think it was just before we took Keith on. I thought, well, how are we going to do this? How are we going to look after all the other members of staff here at Smithton? Well, you know, Ecclesiastes is a book not about pop psychology. It's a book about God's psychology and, frankly, God's insight into the human race. And it's far more interesting, far more radical and life-changing than any of the five-minute books that we see on the bookstand. So we've got verse 1, Solomon, or the writer who's not known. Look at that phrase in verse 1, "Come now, I will test you with pleasure." He is engaged in a series of tests. He's on a journey. Folk used to do this in Victorian times, and before that, they used to go out in a physical journey. They used to move around the world sometimes, the known world, and see what it was all about. They used to test various things out. What is life? Well, 35 years ago, I was a kind of hapless student in Strathclyde University studying primarily English and politics. And one of the authors, of course, is Samuel Beckett, and his most famous piece is Waiting for Godot. He's got another one called The Endgame. There's another play of Beckett's, and it's called The Breath. Now, it lasts for 35 seconds. I don't know how these guys make their money, but it's quite a famous, you can YouTube it. It'll only take you 35 seconds. And basically, what it is, it's a stage, and on the stage is a pile of rubbish, right? So that's the scene. It's opening, and it's a pile of rubbish. And then it's a scream, a tape-recorded scream. There's no actors. And then there's an inhale. You hear a breath being inhaled. And then you hear a breath being exhaled. And then you have a scream again. And that's the curtain. 35 seconds. If I paid money going to a theater for 35 seconds, I'd be wanting my money back. But really, that's what Beckett is saying. Is life just about that? Is life just a breath, insignificant and meaningless? You do these funerals and you're asked to read these poems by people, and you know, 98% of them are absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. There's one called The Dash. It's become quite famous, The Dash. And, you know, the thesis of The Dash, you look at a gravestone, and it's, you know, I don't know, John Smith, born 1951, died, or it doesn't say died, but it's got a little dash, and it's died 2014. And the poem is all about the dash, the bit in the middle. And that is seen as the most significant bit. Folks, if that is the most significant bit, then our situation is hopeless. If all there is the dash, if our life is simply that, then we are, of all people, most miserable. Rod Steiger says, "We come, we go, and in between we try to understand." We come, we go, and in between we try to understand. And so, folks, what is it all about? Chapter 1 is giving us a bird's eye view of this. Chapter 2 is giving us various tests. At the peak of her career, Raquel Welsh. Now, if I said Raquel Welsh, most folk in here, well, maybe not most folk, maybe 30% would not have a clue who I was talking about. Who on earth is Raquel Welsh? To my generation, she was a very well-known, I don't know what she was, a model, an actress. That's the point. See, nobody's, young folk, you've not really even heard of a lady. She said this in an interview. I acquired everything I wanted, yet I was totally miserable. I thought it very peculiar that I'd acquired everything I wanted when a child. Wealth, fame, accomplishment in my career. I had beautiful children and a lifestyle that seemed so terrific, yet I was totally and miserably unhappy. I found it very frightening that one could acquire all these things and still be so miserable. There we are at the airport lounge when we have finished speed reading our pop psychology book. We look out into the foyer, and there we see the raffle. It's a Ferrari there, isn't it? You just, excuse me, spend £10, and maybe you've got a chance to win that Ferrari or a Porsche or whatever it is. And you look at all the glamorous people who seem to inhabit airports, and there you are in your EasyJet flight to, I don't know, Benidorm or somewhere, and you feel so inferior to everyone else in this sophisticated world, and you say, I am nothing. God says, no, 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 no. So let's look at the passage, and let's look at the preacher's various tests. It's actually a great passage for this time of year, isn't it? It's an unlikely Christmas text, but it's so relevant because it's asking, you know, about our pleasure season. So many folk, young folk, old folk, going to parties, going to various stuff, trying to grab the action. Let's talk about a man who has been there, seen it, done it, bought the T-shirt. Four things. Number one, notice here we have the way of escapism. That's the very first thing that he has tried out here. The way of escapism. You see it there, verses 1, 2, and 3. He's a bit downcast, and he's saying, well, what are the options? What are the possibilities? What are the ways out? He says, well, first of all, there's laughter. Do you see that? Laughter, I said, is foolish. That was what his thesis there in chapter 2. Do you remember the Reader's Digest? You know, you only read it in doctor's surgeries, don't you? I was reading one last week. I was in the doctor's surgery, and there's a little section there. Laughter is the best medicine. Is it? Is laughter the best medicine? Comedy, laughter is huge in these days. One of the biggest shows on TV is Live at the Apollo. It's incredible. Peter Kay, who is a comedian, allegedly, earned £20 million in his last DVD. I thought that was absolutely incredible. There were funnier guys than Peter Kay I went to school with in Paisley, and I'm sure they didn't earn £20 million. But comedy's huge. You go to the big city, stand-up comedy clubs. A lot of young folk are going out. You're just listening to folk. I wonder, are you someone who spends hours looking at funny YouTube clips on your mobile phones? There's thousands of them out there, aren't there? Is laughter the answer? You know, young folk say, well, it's just get a laugh, and you go onto YouTube and you look at all these things, you know, grannies hitting Mercedes and the airbags going off, and that's funny, and cats going up curtains and down curtains, and laughter. Is that what it is? You see, that's a way of escapism. Are we saying, oh, well, that's typical, that's the free church defaulting to their original position, you know, they're kind of, you know, miserable, you know, that's what I'm paid for, to go up and saying here, you know, doomed, we're all doomed, miserable is, you know, misery is the way forward. No, there's nothing wrong with laughter, but it's not the answer, is it? Tony Hancock was, again, if you've heard of Racco Welsh, you've heard of Tony Hancock. They are 1960s, really humorous comedian. Hancock's Half Hour was a program in my young day. In 1968, he took his own life. Now, the reasons behind suicide, I think, are complex. I'm not dealing with it simplistically, but the point is that he seemed to be a really, really happy guy. And yet, he said like this 2 days before he died, I want this in my gravestone. He came, he went, in between nothing. He came, he went, in between nothing. No, he says here, laughter, I said, see that in verse 2? Laughter, I said, is foolish. The word there for foolish, the Hebrew word in Philip Ryken's commentary on Ecclesiastes, he says that that's a very interesting word, that word foolish. It actually denotes sinful. He's not saying that all laughter is sinful, but a lot of laughter is at the expense of others. I watched Jonathan Ross last night, and there was a lot of laughter on it. And then I noticed, after having prepared this sermon, so much of that laughter was at the expense of other people. So much of that laughter was, frankly, cruel, sarcastic, frivolous, based on bad material. And then I thought, yeah, so much of laughter is based on reductionism, cruelty, sarcasm. It's a way of escapism. Laughter. I'm not wanting anybody here to be miserable, but I'm saying, look, laughter, comedy, you know, hilarity, it's good. But is it part of a balanced diet? Laughter, and then there's general pleasures there, aren't there? And what does pleasure accomplish? Again, my commentators tell me that word pleasure is really interesting. The word pleasure there means kind of highbrow pleasure. You know, not a night at Cadona's. Apologies to anybody who thinks that's a good night out. A night at Cadona's and a pie supper afterwards and some mushy peas. That's not what he's talking about here. He's talking about highbrow stuff. A night at the theatre and canapes and caviar. You know, the finer things of life. Art, music, community. Things that lift our souls. The things that the chattering classes enjoy. The Guardian readers enjoy. The Telegraph readers are at the other end. They enjoy these. The pleasures. The things that are really, you know, noble. That's what the word pleasure there means in verse 2. And what does pleasure accomplish? These headings should have come up. I think my formatting has gone on holiday for Christmas. But the third one, the way of escapism there is wine. Do you see it there? Verse 3. I tried cheering myself with wine. Now, this is no lager lout. This is someone who's looking for a bit of lubricant for their laughter. He's no Philistine. On his bookcase is Johnson & Johnson's Atlas of World Wine. This is a man who knows his wines. He had big tastes. We don't have time, but look at 1 Kings 4. And you see there King Solomon's tastes, for example. It wasn't Aldi and Lidl for him. Not even Sainsbury's or Waitrose. He's past that. He was really, really into the big stuff. The way of escapism, laughter, pleasures, wine. I read this, and I read it on the internet, so it must be true. It said this, today, 2014, I found this unbelievable. It said that the average Briton spends £50,000 in their lifetime on alcohol. Now, it's one of those statistics I really would like to question. I really would like to question it. But I'm taking out the point is that I think we probably spend more than we think. Macmillan Cancer Support, a little bit more reliable, did a survey recently, and they found that each Briton spends, on average, £787 a year on alcohol, with London drinkers spending a lot more. The One Poll, a reputable survey, surveyed 2,000 over 18s. Men spent an average of £934.44 per year on alcohol. Women spent an average of £678.60 on alcohol. Irrelevant? Relevant to a congregation like this? We are largely well-heeled, respectable people. Maybe that's the demographic that people miss out on, that we find ourselves drinking more and more and more. Why? To dull the pain more and more. Why? Because there is behind it all a spiritual hunger. I'm not coming here to judge. But God here is saying, Solomon's looked at it all. He's saying, is that the answer to life? Is that the answer to all our problems? Laughter, pleasures, wine? We're not talking here about the homeless person drinking really cheap stuff. We're talking here about the respectable person in their home, but they've got a problem. The way of escapism, laughter, pleasures, and wine. I wonder, do young folk see this amongst their peers? Do older folk see this among their peers? So that's the first test, the way of escapism. The second test is the way of creativity. You see that in verse 4 onwards? Now, not everyone is watching Michael McIntyre with a bottle of cheap red to keep them going through the night. See, this is the thing. We very often imagine that the pursuit of sin, and this often comes from a kind of testimony culture, you know, a testimony subculture that says, you know, that a really valid Christian testimony is someone who was a gangster, someone who was a murderer, someone who was an extremist, and someone who was in the margins of society, but all of a sudden they experience a dramatic conversion. I'm not sure if these sorts of testimonies are all that helpful. Look at this guy here. He's saying, look, I went down the way of creativity. Look at chapter verse 4. I undertook many great projects. It says, I built houses for myself, planted vineyards, I made gardens and parks, and planted all kinds of fruits and trees in them. He was into architecture, horticulture, engineering. See that in verse 6? I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. It's interesting here, but what I spot there is what I've spotted in the lives of so many people. Maybe it's your neighbor and they've got this amazing house, a gorgeous garden, and it really is quite something. And they are moral living people. But actually, you know, here's the, I'm going to suggest the psychology here is, what we have, I think in verse 4, 5, and 6, is almost a rebuilding of Eden, isn't it? We've got a secular Eden. We've got a secular attempt to bring perfection in on this earth. Is that your neighbor? Is that you? Someone engaged in a housing project, a garden project, something big like that. It's looking so great. It's pristine. It is wonderful. There's a wow factor. But what they are doing is building something around themselves that's absolutely perfect. It's like the Truman Show that we saw this morning, this kind of bubble of secular Eden where nothing imperfect is allowed to come in. Trying to create an environment round about themselves that will out-God God, that will be so, I don't know, redolent and will be so fertile and will be so self-sufficient that they do not need God at all. That's how often creative people are the most anti-God. Because they are doing what God does, and they are trying to rebuild their lives in the image of God. There was creative investment, 7 and 8, wasn't there? He was creative in acquisition. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I had more herds than flocks than anyone else, verse 8. I amassed silver and gold for myself. Gold is big just now, actually. I was on the way over this morning, I think it was in the car, there was a program on about gold, and that's always the way to go. That's your little financial tip for tonight. Gold, you know, because society puts a value on gold. Look at verse 9 and 10. He had it all. Literally, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied nothing. I denied myself nothing. My eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. Verse 10, my heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. He's in the front of Fortune magazine. There's supermodels draped on his arms. Look at verse 11. Yet, when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind, nothing was gained under the sun. Bob Geldof's autobiography is entitled, Is That It? That's what he said, wasn't it? After, was it Band-Aid? All the organization, all the life-changing things that happened there, the people in possession, when it was, is that it? You have this experience, the party season, you go along to the party. Is that it? Stories for the boys in the morning. Oh, I 10 pints last night, that's nothing. I had 20 pints, oh, that's nothing. Is that it? The way of creativity. That follows the way of escapism. But let's look at a third one. The way of traditional values, I've called it. The way of traditional values. So maybe you're not a party animal. Maybe you're not a hard-working, creative type who's got an Apple Mac. Maybe you're not that sort of person. Maybe you're solid, stolid. Just the ordinary guy and girl getting on with life. What's your ways? Well, the ways of traditional values. There are two. Verse 12 is wisdom. Then I turn my thoughts to consider wisdom. This is not the fear of the Lord, which is the beginning of wisdom. This is not the wisdom that's spoken about here. This is more of what I've called, you know, the educating Rita type wisdom. You know, the desire for knowledge. It's a myth that people are reading less. People are actually reading more. Bookshops are experiencing a very slight renaissance. And, you know, people are reading voraciously. People are reading more. The quality of books is going down, I think. Remember, in the Victorian era, Dickens was just ordinary stuff. You know, Dickens was just what the punter on the street read. It wasn't highfalutin literature. But maybe that's your wisdom. You're interested in things and you're reading. You're reading widely. You're reading a good newspaper. You're reading blogs. You're really, you know, never before has there been so much information. I don't know if you're like me. You're watching TV sometimes with an iPod and you're signing. You think, well, who's that? Ah, who is that person in question time? And you Google it and you're watching it and you're all finding out who they are. Information, anything you want. What is the drinking habits of the average Briton? Just Google it and it's there. Knowledge. Wisdom. You're coming brighter and brighter and brighter. That's true of many folk here. We're bookworms. We're reading all the time. There's this thirst for knowledge, for ideas, for philosophy, for poetry, for many things. It's a world I love, a world of ideas. But the problem is, yes, he concedes, verse 13, wisdom is better than folly, just as light is better than darkness. But then he says in verse 14, but I came to realize that the same fate overtakes them both. It's the dash, isn't it? The same fate overcomes them both. Voltaire, I hate life, yet I am afraid to die. So yes, there's wisdom, but there's also work. 18 to 23, he talks about work. He's working all the time. And again, isn't that in our own culture another various way of escaping? Folks say, oh, work, so busy just now. And people are increasingly obsessed with work, and everybody's stressed. Public services are stressed. The NHS is stressed. The education services are stressed. Social work's stressed. Private business is stressed. Folk have got to make money. Work. Camus said, without work, all life goes rotten. But when work is soulless, life stifles and dies. So we work, 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 work. This is really dark stuff. Because verse 18 says here, I work, I work, I work, and then you die, and then someone else might get it. Verse 19, he says, and who knows whether he will be a wise man or a fool? You know, you work, you work, you work, you work, and the guy that you sit beside in the bus, some fool by some quirk of providence, gets all your money. Verse 21, for a man may do his work with wisdom, knowledge, and skill, and then he must leave all he owns to someone who has not worked for it. This is so true, isn't it? One generation work hard, the next generation squander it. Verse 22 and 23 says, for all that effort, we are just left with a load of grief. Many will recognize verse 23. All his days, his work is pain and grief. Even at night, his mind does not rest. This too is meaningless. Are you a traditionalist? Not a waster, but a wise worker. Is that the path you've trod? Yeah, we see that these three ways are ways that really lead to nowhere. Well, in this dark, wet night, can we offer some hope? Yes, I think we can. The fourth one is the way of supernatural contentment. Try not and read that big quote just now. I'm not quite ready for the big quote. Okay, don't read the big quote just now. Heading, the way of supernatural contentment. Look at verse 24 onwards. A man can do nothing better than eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. You see, one of the keys to Ecclesiastes is he sees life in two perspectives. There's life under the sun, and there's life above the sun. A few weeks ago, after reading my pop psychology book at Gatwick, and after not spending my £10 for an opportunity with 5 million other folk to win a Lotus, I went into the plane from Gatwick to Inverness, and it was your usual winter Gatwick night. Foggy, smoggy, wet, damp, drich. I don't know if one can use the word drich south of the border, but it was drich, and man, it was depressing. So you get into your EasyJet at Gatwick, and all of a sudden it takes off, and you go through the clouds, and you're in another world. You rise above the clouds, the sun is shining, the sky is blue, the light fills the place. This is paradise. There is not a spot of rain in sight. It is cloudless as far as the eye can see. This is life above the sun. And there's a palpable change there, isn't there, in verse 24? The key changes. He's been brought into a whole new realm, a world which screams, all shall be well. What is the transfer from the world below the sun to the world above the sun? What changes the key? What is the game changer in our lives? Here we are in church here watching the screen, and we are in this situation of utter despair. We are looking at the future and we are seeing nothing ahead. It all seems so sterile and impotent. We feel barren within ourselves. What's the game changer? The game changer is God is in the situation. Do you see that all the time? I have seen the burden God has. Verse 24. This too is from the hand of God. For without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? Now, what's interesting is that this verse says, a man can do nothing better than eat and drink. And it talks about happiness, and it talks about knowledge. It talks about the same things that it's spoken about before. It's interesting. What does that suggest? It suggests that it's not these things which are bad. There's nothing wrong with a wee glass of Chardonnay. There's nothing wrong with a nice manicured garden. There's nothing wrong with the acquisition of good things, of gold. There's nothing wrong with laughter. But if these things are pursued in a godless way, they are a cul-de-sac. What's the difference? The difference is this. If we demand from things more than they were designed to deliver, we will be disappointed. If we look at a relationship so often, we will be disappointed because no matter how noble, no matter how good, that cannot provide salvation. That cannot unite us to God. C.S. Lewis quote, I'm ready for it now. Most people, if they had really learned to look into their own hearts, would know that they do want and want acutely something that cannot be had in this world. There are all sorts of things in this world that offer to give it to you, but they never quite keep their promise. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or when we first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. Everyone in here, everyone watching on the net, on the DVD, whether it's in Achiltibuie or Campbellton or wherever you're watching this tonight, or if it's in the morning, every one of us, we were designed for a craving for transcendence, a craving for God, a craving for this relationship with God that can only be effected through Jesus Christ. The bridge, the introducer. Are there some of us, and maybe I'm among the first in the queue, who are in that if only place? If only I had that £100,000. If only I was married. If only I wasn't married. If only I was married to her. If only I was married to him. If only I had got that job. If only. And yet it's not filling the gap. We dictate to God when he wants to give us so much more. He wants to give us so much more. I wonder, are you settling for far too little in life? Let me end. John Wesley writes in his journal, Thursday 2nd, 1777. I began expounding, he says, in order, the book of Ecclesiastes. I never before had so clear a sight either of the meaning or of the beauties of it. Neither did I imagine that the several parts of it were in such an exquisite manner connected together, all tending to prove that grand truth, that there is no happiness outside God. That's why the party didn't satisfy. That's how the PhD was not enough. That's why the marriage was not happy enough. That's why the money is never enough. Because you need God in your life. And Jesus is God. He is a great connector. Folk, we can have that now. He's only a prayer away. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, for its clarity, for its relevance. Help us to meet with you and to enjoy you. Speak to our church, our culture, our society. Help us to know life above the clouds. Forgive our sins. Amen.